let's cultivate our motivation and think that we're all here to get in touch with the spiritual aspects of our lives. We all want to develop wisdom and compassion, to subdue our anger, greed, and ignorance. That's very, very worthwhile to do. And while we're doing that, let's remember that all other living beings also have that same aim. But just like us, sometimes they get lost in their afflictive emotions, and they have no tools to help themselves. So let's have a sense of equal-hearted compassion for all living beings. Not holding ourselves superior, not holding friends as more important, but seeing ourselves and others as all equal. And with that mind of compassion, work for the benefit of all. And especially with the wish to make a positive contribution to society. And in the long term, to help all living beings free their minds from confusion and self-centeredness. So open your eyes and come out of your meditation. Okay, so the chapter on mindful awareness. So this is Russell's chapter, but I think I can explain it as he means it. So he says, a common obstacle to compassion occurs when our minds are swept away by troublesome emotions and thoughts. True, isn't it? I mean, we all want to be compassionate, but then, you know, anger, jealousy, something like that comes up in our mind and our compassion's out the window. It's relatively easy to experience kindness and compassion when everything is going well. The trouble comes when anger, fear, jealousy, anxiety, critical thoughts, and so on leap into our minds. If we're not paying attention, we can lose ourselves in such thoughts and emotions, and our compassion quickly fades away. Yeah, our experience, huh? Over the last few decades, Western mental health professionals have used mindfulness approaches adapted from traditional Buddhist practices to help their patients work with difficult thoughts and emotions. A quickly growing body of research shows that the regular practice of mindfulness meditation can even lead to growth in the areas of the brain linked with emotional regulation, sense of self-identity, compassion, and empathy. There are many excellent books and resources on mindfulness. If you are interested in learning more, what follows is a brief introduction on how increasing our mindfulness can aid in developing our compassionate potential. So he's going to be speaking here from the viewpoint of a psychologist who has borrowed some techniques of Buddhist meditation to use in a secular sense. Okay, so the secular mindfulness that he's talking about is different than Buddhist mindfulness. Okay, because he's taking it out of the Buddhist context and saying how it's useful to practice in our daily lives in order to develop compassion. Okay? I just want to make that clear, because otherwise people can get confused between Buddhist mindfulness and secular mindfulness. Also, in the secular sense, there's many different people who are practicing mindfulness, and they may teach different techniques. So just to be aware of that as well, okay? So he's going to define what he means by mindfulness here, and then I'll hold that for a minute. Okay, what exactly is mindfulness? In the psychological community, so he's specifying the psychological community, yeah, we generally define mindfulness as purposeful, non-judgmental awareness of what is happening inside us and around us in the present moment. So I might call that bare attention, you know, just being aware of what's going on in you and in your environment. But the psychological sense is calling it mindfulness. Okay? With mindful awareness, we neither cling to nor reject our experiences. We simply notice and accept them as they are. For example, we can discuss a sensitive issue with a family member and notice our voice is growing louder with an edge to it. We then become aware that this is because we feel threatened and are getting defensive and angry. This mindful awareness gives us the ability to make wise choices. For example, to slow down and to think before we speak. If we fail to notice troublesome thoughts and emotions and to recognize them as temporary mental experiences, it can be easy to be swept away by them. Okay? So here he's talking about mindfulness as awareness, okay, in this example here, that our voice is growing louder, you know, so, okay, what's happening with my voice? Awareness, what's happening with my mind? Oh, I'm getting defensive, I'm angry, yeah. And then because of noticing these things, you know, having thought about before and knowing, oh, gee, when I get defensive and angry, I often say and do things that aren't really what I mean in the long term, and that can really damage relationships that I care about. And so being aware of that, then deciding, okay, I need to slow down, maybe process what's going on inside of me, and then, you know, before I speak. Because we all know how it is, you know, sometimes without this kind of self-awareness, anger comes very quickly, you know, or selfishness comes very quickly. And before we know what's happening, it's coming out of our mouth or coming out of our fist, okay? And then we're sitting there going, oh my God, what's happening? You know, how did I get here? Okay, we can consider a couple of examples. I, Russell, have done a lot of therapy work, both with parents who are struggling to parent their challenging children and with adults who have had terrible childhood relationships with their own parents. Imagine a situation in which a child does something that really pushes our buttons. How many of you have kids? How many of your kids push your buttons? They're some of the best button pushers, aren't they? Yeah, they really know how to get to you. Of course, you know really how to get to them too. So it's equal. Okay, so Russell has a son. So he's giving an example of his own experience. Okay, so for example, my son gets excited and accidentally bumps into my favorite acoustic guitar, sending it careening off of its stand onto the brick fireplace and putting a deep gouge into its side. Okay, so you may not have an acoustic guitar, but I'm sure some similar thing has happened with a child that has ruined something you really like. Of course, we never did that when we were kids, did we? In the heat of the moment, anger rapidly rising within us, it might be easy to thoughtlessly say things that can cause our loved one great pain, things that we would never say when we're at our best. Why can't you look where you're going? Are you stupid? I can't have anything nice without you destroying it. Get out of here. That would come very easily. You can see here exactly what his parents said to him. Now, those of you who are parents, did you make certain determinations to yourself never to say to your kids what your parents said to you? And do you find those same things coming out of your mouth? Yeah, that's the force of habit, isn't it? Yeah. So that's what his experience was. These comments can cause long-lasting harm, particularly if they are repeated time and time again over the course of many years. Mindful awareness can help us notice when we are overcome by powerful emotions, so we steer ourselves towards a better course of action. Wow, I am really angry right now. Anything I say to him while I'm feeling this way is likely to be hurtful, so I better keep quiet for the time being. Yeah. Having taken a step back from the powerful emotion, a host of other possibilities open up, like slowing down my breathing, reminding myself that it was an accident, it was only a guitar, and if I'm really that concerned about keeping it unblemished, I'd be better off keeping it in its case rather than on a tippy stand in a high traffic area near a brick fireplace with a kid who likes to run around. Once I've calmed myself, I might even become aware of this as a valuable teaching experience, a chance to demonstrate to my son how to handle stressful situations in a calm, balanced manner, rather than flying off the handle, the way I'd want him to handle such situations as an adult. So realizing when these things happen, you're setting an example for your child about how to handle similar experiences. In the same way that, how did you learn to say the, you know, awful things to your kid? Because your parents set that example. Yeah, so it's kind of making a decision to cut that chain. Over time, such interactions can help him develop the ability to deal with frustrating situations in helpful ways himself, if, as a parent, you set the example. Since we're on the topic of parenting, it's worth noting that mindfulness can also be applied to other emotions, like fear and anxiety. One of the tricks of good parenting is being able to tolerate some discomfort or fear when our children start to venture out on their own. How many of you as parents have some discomfort or fear when your kids start wanting to do things without you? Yeah? Are they going to be safe? Do they know what they're doing? What's going to happen if they get hurt and I'm not around? Is anybody looking over them? Oh, what's going to happen if they fall? Oh, this, and, you know, well, you know. I don't need to go into detail about that one. This occurs throughout their development, from when they begin to walk, run, and play independently on playgrounds, jumping around, inevitably falling, to when they begin dating, applying for jobs, and eventually leave home. In each case, good parenting requires us to balance giving our children the support they need, okay, and the freedom to learn to manage challenging life situations on their own. So kids need both. They need support and they need freedom. Yeah. If we're unable to observe and accept feelings of fear or our desire to have control, parents, do you have desire to have control? So if we if we're unable to observe these, we can easily become overprotective and controlling in the effort to make sure our children never come into contact with harm, while inadvertently crippling them in the process. Yeah, because if you don't give your kid freedom, they don't know how to deal with difficult situations. And they grow up, when something happens, just at a loss. What do I do? And as a parent, you're not always going to be there to rush in and save the day. So the kids need, you know, to learn to make decisions and, you know, to see the effects of their actions. And thus to learn, you know, sometimes how to make better decisions. If we're overwhelmed by these emotions, we may engage in perhaps an even less helpful strategy, ignoring or turning away from our children entirely because we can't handle the discomfort that comes from watching them struggle. Yeah, so some parents deal with it that way. You know, it's like your kids are growing up. It's so difficult to watch them struggle and learn. You're so afraid and anxious. So you just turn away, keep yourself busy with the things that you like and ignore your kids or don't talk to them about, you know, well, what's happening in your life and what are you feeling? And, you know, so not engaging the kids. So some parents deal with it that way. I think now a lot of parents go to the other extreme, okay? But we're getting to that. Mindful awareness allows us to observe, accept, and take responsibility for our own emotions so we can work with them rather than having these emotions dictate our actions. Of course, it's hard to watch my daughter go through this. And this could be anything from falling off playground equipment to going through a painful breakup. And to acknowledge it's difficult to watch your kid go through hard experiences. But this is how she's going to learn to manage such situations on her own. What would help me manage my own emotions so I can be here for her when she needs me, but still allow her to develop as an individual. So asking yourself that as a parent. To return to the subject of troublesome thoughts and emotions, we often take our thoughts to be the absolute truth, experiencing them as the way it is, and unsurprisingly, have powerful reactions to them. Our emotions are very powerful, but they often aren't terribly clever. They're not very good at distinguishing between what is happening to us in the outside world and the thoughts and images we produce in our own mind. Okay? So with the example of the parents, you know, your child's going up, they need, you know, they have certain developmental stages they go through, and they need the freedom to learn and go through those stages. But as a parent, you're anxious, yeah? And so, you know, what you imagine in your mind is like worst case scenario, yeah? Like, oh, she's going to fall off the playground equipment and hit her head and be paralyzed forever. Or, you know, she's going through a difficult breakup with her boyfriend, and from now on she's never going to have any relationships. She's going to just retreat inside of her and be depressed forever. Okay, So you imagine worst case scenarios, and then you believe that they're true. Yeah? And then that produces more anxiety and more fear and more worry. Okay? And so here he talked about one parental strategy where you turn away from your kid. The other one that's very prominent today is helicopter parenting. Yeah? Where you are always fluttering in a helicopter over the right shoulder or left shoulder or head, or maybe you have many helicopters around. Do, you know, look at every aspect of your child's life because you're so anxious to make sure that everything is going to go okay and that there's nothing bad is going to happen to your kid. And so you're like this and you interfere with your kid's life. Yeah. Before they make a mistake, you've got to step in and say, oh no, don't do that. Don't, this is dangerous. That's dangerous. You know, to go this way. Listen to me. I have the proper advice. Oh, you stubbed your little toe. Let me take care of it. Let's kiss it and make it better. They're 25. You know, but you're so anxious and worried. You've got to control every aspect of your kid's life. Did any of you have parents like that? Yeah. Yeah, some ethnic groups, this is it, you know? But think about it. I mean, how does that make you feel when you don't have space to grow? It's very confining. And it's very interesting for us here to watch sometimes the young people that come and what their parents will do for them. You know, they will drive like from, where is it? Like from Michigan here, you know, to bring their child here, or their child is unhappy one day and they want to leave, and the parents drive from, where was it? I don't know, Tennessee or Kentucky, pick their child home and go home. It's unbelievable, you know? And, oh, we had another thing. I won't go into too many stories, but wow, we've seen some helicopter parents here. And it doesn't have a good effect on the kids. It really doesn't. Yeah, I remember one young man just, it made him, you know, he took on the anxiety of his parents. Anyway, I didn't have kids, so I have liberty to talk about how everybody else parents. My mother used to say, just wait until you have kids. Then you'll know what I've gone through. Yeah, so I didn't have any. Okay. We have cats instead. And they present their own challenges. Okay. So now he's going to give an example of how we impute things on other people. But we believe our thoughts, our erroneous thoughts, and act on our erroneous thoughts. So he says, for example, imagine that halfway through Joe's public talk and 20 minutes before the bank closes, Gina, who's in the audience, a woman sitting in the front row, recalls she forgot to deposit a check into her bank account needed to cover a number of debits that will be due over the weekend. Frowning and grumbling to herself because she forgot to take care of this, she quickly stands up and leaves the room. So Joe, who's giving the talk, notices this and interprets her behavior in a self-critical way. She thinks I'm incompetent and that my talk is nonsense. He'll likely experience the same emotions as if she had said those things to him directly. Shame, anxiety, embarrassment, and perhaps hostility towards Gina. So don't anybody walk out of my talk. Actually, I've had a lot of people walk off out of my talks, and I never know their reasons, but I wish them well. But we know, in fact, the situation had nothing to do with Joe. He completely misinterpreted Gina's actions. We tend to be very sensitive to perceived threats, which can lead to problems such as mistakenly interpreting events in the worst possible way and having powerful emotional responses to mental events, thoughts, imageries, fantasies that have little to do with what's actually going on. So this is a big problem that all of us have, because things happen, we interpret them to have a certain meaning. We interpret, mind read and think we know the other person's motivation for doing what they did. And our mind reading is always to impute a negative motivation. Yeah. And then we take offense at what the person did. We get all worked up about it. We never bother to talk to the other person to see what was actually going on with them. But we act towards them as if the whole fantasy we've created in our own mind is the reality of the situation, when it's not. Okay, you know what I'm talking about? But we think that what our conceptualization of the situation is the absolute truth. You know, we never think, I'm projecting, I'm imputing. We think, I'm perceiving reality objectively out there. Okay? And we can't distinguish between just the objective data and our own interpretation and projection on it. Okay? And this causes a lot of communication problems with people. Yeah? Now, try to imagine Joe responding differently. Imagine he is aware of the thought, Gina thinks I'm incompetent, my talk is nonsense, and he recognizes it as simply a thought. He pauses to reflect, I wonder if there is another explanation for her behavior. She seemed to be engaged and interested during the rest of my talk. Perhaps something else is going on of which I'm unaware. Imagine how different Joe's emotional response would be when he is aware of what is happening in his mind. Yeah? Because I tell you, because people always walk out of talks, you know, they have to get home. Maybe they have a babysitter, they have to wake up early in the morning. They have to go to the bathroom, they're exhausted, they have all sorts of reasons, you know. But if, as a speaker, you interpret everything an audience member does as rejection or criticism of yourself, you drive yourself totally crazy, you know. And it has nothing to do with the reality of the situation. So we don't just do that kind of thing in speaker situations, but so many of our life situations are like that. Yeah, we just totally misinterpret what somebody's meaning. With mindfulness, we train ourselves to recognize and accept our mental experiences as temporary mental experiences without judging or clinging to them. So without like, oh, there I go again, I'm misinterpreting what somebody did and projecting negative emotions on them. When am I ever going to learn? This is, you know, I'm just a disaster. So don't go into self-judgment. That's not the point. Yeah, that also is more projection. That is not true. Relating to our thoughts and emotions as temporary experiences rather than identifying them as who we are or the way things are, gives us some space to work with them. It's the difference between getting completely caught up in anger and instead observing, I am really angry right now. I wonder what would help me work with this feeling. Now, so there's a big difference between the self-awareness of, oh, I'm getting upset, and no self-awareness, believing that our emotion is the only response we can have to a situation that we think is real, but is actually one we've invented. The acronym RAIN, R-A-I-N, can be useful in helping us to remember the psychological process involved in mindfulness. So R is recognize what is going on inside of us. A is accept and allow our experience to be what it is. I is investigate our experience, looking closely at what is happening within us. And N is non-identification, which means observing our experience without becoming one with it. Okay? So mindfulness allows us to have an accepting, non-judgmental awareness of our thoughts and emotions without necessarily buying into them. If you find that you start judging yourself, then you have the mindfulness of, oh, I'm judging myself. Yeah? Is judging myself really an appropriate, you know, you accept it? Okay, I'm judging myself. Yeah, then you investigate it. You know, why am I judging myself? What brought this on? And then you, non-identification is, well, it's just a thought and probably not a very accurate one at thought at that. So let's just put it down. So this changes how we think and talk about our emotions. For example, recognizing that I am feeling angry rather than I am angry. Okay. The first statement recognizes anger as an experience within the larger body of our awareness, a temporary mental state. The second reflects identification. We feel fused with the emotion and can't see a way to work with it. Okay. Mindfulness helps us develop compassion because the more aware we are of our shifting thoughts and emotional states, the better prepared we'll be to work with the difficult ones and to cultivate the mental experiences that we want to have, such as compassion. We can also choose to bring compassion into our mindful awareness. In this way, we practice mindfulness and self-compassion in tandem, thinking, I'm feeling angry or anxious or jealous or sad or whatever it is right now. How can I help myself work with this suffering? Okay, so we're having some disturbing emotion, again, without criticism, without self-judgment, you know, just to have some acceptance. This is arising in my mind. How can I help myself work with this? A common method of training in mindfulness begins with mindfully observing the breath. To do this, we sit upright and gently settle our attention on the breath. When our attention wanders as thoughts or distractions come to mind, we notice and accept them and gently bring our attention back to the breath. There's no need to get frustrated when we find ourselves carried away by our thoughts. Yeah, so it's not like, oh, look, everybody in this room is so concentrated. And my mind is all over the universe. I'm a failure. They're all in samadhi. Yeah. Let me reassure you, no, that's not what's happening. Okay? So getting carried away by thoughts is, it's natural that distractions arise, and we'll gradually get better at not getting carried away by them. In fact, these distractions help us get better at learning to notice movement in the mind, noticing when thoughts and emotions arise in our mind, which will help us work with these experiences. Over time, we'll notice these thoughts more quickly, accept them, release them, and bring our mindful awareness back to the breath. The purpose of returning our attention to the breath is not to suppress or ignore our thoughts and emotions. It is to help us learn to notice them and to give ourselves some mental space so we don't automatically get caught up in unproductive thoughts that make us miserable. Yeah. Because so much of our day-to-day unhappiness and even long-term misery is because of what we're thinking. It's not due to the external reality of the situation. It's about how we are conceptualizing about the situation. I'll give you I'll finish this paragraph and then I'll give you a little story. There are many good books and resources available to help us learn mindfulness. And a number of them are provided at the end of the book. And guided audio meditations of mindful breathing exercises can be found. And he gave his URL. Yeah, his website. Okay. So a little story from yesterday. Okay. I was working in the forest with one of the volunteers who came in the morning, and we were lopping the dead branches and, you know, trying to clean up a certain area. And at one point, he got stung by a yellow jacket or a wasp. I don't know what it was. And so he came in, put the, you know, baking soda on it, came out and continued working. So fine, okay. He accepted what happened. Life went on. Then in the afternoon, he went out again. This time I wasn't with him. And he wrote me at the end of the day. He emailed me and he said, well, wouldn't you know it, I went out to the forest in the afternoon. I got stung again. Not a good day at the forest. And I wrote back to him because he's a practitioner. He's not somebody who's new to the Dharma. Yeah, so he knows some of the thought training techniques. And often with thought training, what we do when we face adversity or pain or whatever is we say, good, I'm glad this happened. I can learn from the experience. It's a ripening of my own negative karma that's now finished. And it's, you know, the situation itself isn't a disaster. It could have, you know, this karma could have ripened in something really awful. So when he wrote me and said, oh, not a good day at the forest, I wrote back and I said, what do you mean not a good day? You just purified a ton of negative karma. Yeah, that could have brought all sorts of suffering in the future. Yeah, so I would only say this to somebody who is already a practitioner, because somebody who's not would misinterpret and think, oh, Buddhism sounds very masochistic, but it's not. You know, like, oh, gee, I better go find some wasps today to help me purify my negative karma. Yeah, no, we're not advocating that. Okay, but he was a practitioner, so yeah, I knew he would understand it. So I wrote him that, and then he wrote me back, and he said, oh, thank you, I wasn't thinking very clearly. But I think the reason I said that to him is because I knew he would then switch his way of thinking, and then instead of feeling, oh, it was a bad day, he would feel, oh, it was a good day. And he would also remember that coming up here, he saw all his Dharma friends, and, you know, he would remember everything good about the day instead of letting two wasps dictate his whole feeling about a day. Okay? Because that easily could happen, isn't it? You get stung by wasps. Oh, no, I'm never going to Srivasti Abbey again. They have wasps. Yeah, well, that means you're never going anywhere outside where they have concrete and asphalt. Yeah, because everywhere around here, there's bugs. You know, and there's more of them than us. So, yeah, when we intrude on their territory, they let us know. Okay, then there's the section on a reflection, because every chapter in An Open-Hearted Life, at the end there's a reflection so that people can really put it into practice. Okay, so this reflection is called Mindful Checking In. The following exercise will help you become aware of what you are experiencing at a given moment and learn to notice, distinguish, and accept various thoughts and emotions that arise in your mind. Try to pause a few times each day to notice your experience and observe the effects that doing so has on your life. Okay, so you want to do this right now? We have a few minutes. And just lower your eyes. So just a short exercise. So start by bringing attention to your breath and noticing the feeling of your breath entering and leaving your body. Do this for 30 seconds or so. Now shift your attention to your external physical sensations. Notice the sounds coming in through your ears. Notice other bodily sensations, temperature, pressure of your body making contact with the chair or the cushion, and any other physical sensations that you have. They have about the external environment. Now be aware of your internal body sensations, your heart rate, breathing, there's tension anywhere, feeling hungry or feeling full, aches and pains you may be feeling, hot and cold temperatures. So be aware of your internal body sensations. Then be aware of your mental experiences. Notice what you're thinking. For example, this is odd, or I like this, I don't like it. So observe also mental feelings of pleasure or displeasure. Now notice your emotions, interest, irritation, anticipation, boredom, anxiety. Notice how the content of your thoughts can impact how you feel. Now bring your awareness to your motivation, what you want to do, and mental imagery, pictures or fantasies playing out in your mind. bring awareness to these experiences, noticing and accepting your thoughts, emotions, motivations, and mental images as temporary mental events. And then see that as we do this process of checking in, we'll become better at recognizing our physical and mental experiences for what they are, just temporary events. And that will help us not get carried away by them. We can also observe how one mental experience can lead to the next. One thought, one emotion, one image leads to another one, leads to another one, and off we go, completely in our heads, not really relating to the situation we're in. And so bring your attention back to a motivation to really slow down and be aware. And through this, to be able to observe accurately what your experience is and learn to make wise decisions that lead to happiness for yourself and others. So thank you. So we have time for one or two questions.
Explain to me again the difference between Buddhist meditation and secular meditation.
Oh, okay. Well, in Buddhism, there's many, many forms of meditation. Okay? If we talk just about mindfulness meditation, one particular form. In secular the sense, it's what we have here, just observing, bare attention to our thoughts, our feelings, our environment. In Buddhist mindfulness meditation, mindfulness is conjoined with wisdom. So it's not just bare awareness. There's a kind of examination of what something is. And the motivation for doing the meditation is very difficult in the two, different in the two. In secular mindfulness, the motivation is usually to be more peaceful and calm and have a better life, which is wonderful. In Buddhism, our motivation is to attain liberation from the cyclic existence, the cycle of existence, or to become a fully awakened being, a Buddha. So there's a difference in the motivation there too. And a difference in the wisdom. You know, like I said, with Buddhism, the mindfulness is conjoined with wisdom, and it's used to, to go very deep in eliminating our mental afflictions, our ignorance, anger, and attachment. Okay?